Hello, and welcome to episode 87 of the Big Rhetorical Podcast. I'm your host, Charles Woods. This episode is another entry in our Emerging Scholar series. Today, I talk to Noor Ghazal Aswad.
And his parents actually videotaped his body, and they put the video online. Talking about it now, even now, when I think about it, like the hair on my body stands up, because that was, I mean, when people saw what the regime had done to him, and it was kind of teaching people a lesson, like, if you're going to protest, this is what's going to happen to you. Instead of being cowed or scared, Syrians actually couldn't take it anymore.
You'll hear more from Noor in a bit. But first, I want to direct your attention to three opportunities available with the WAC Clearinghouse. The WAC Clearinghouse has openings for three leadership positions: the Associate Publisher for Monographs, Collections, and Conference Proceedings, Director of Operations, and Director of Production. The Associate Publisher for Monographs, Collections, and Conference Proceedings supports the publication by the WAC Clearinghouse of scholarly monographs and collections, as well as conference proceedings. The associate publisher works with the publisher and book series editors to ensure that clearinghouse publications meet the highest standards of scholarship, design, and accessibility. The director of operations works with the publisher and other members of the clearinghouse leadership team to ensure the smooth operation of the clearinghouse. Key duties include reviewing, updating, and coordinating the implementation of practices focusing on diversity, equity, and inclusion, organizational partnerships, database partnerships, and awards, among other potential areas. The Director of Operations is a new position. The Director of Production works with the publisher and other members of the Clearinghouse leadership team to support production of the Clearinghouse website, books, journals, and resources. Key duties will include assessing and improving Clearinghouse websites, identifying and addressing accessibility of the websites and publications, overseeing the assignment and accuracy of DOIs, identifying and testing potential development tools, and engaging in graphic design, among other potential areas. The Director of Production is a new position as well. The individuals selected for these positions will serve as members of the operational leadership team within the WAC Clearinghouse. They will also serve as a member of the Clearinghouse Editorial Board. Like all other positions with the WAC Clearinghouse, these positions are voluntary and unpaid. The expected term is 3 years and may be renewed. To apply, please send a letter of application and a current CV to Mike Palmquist at mike.palmquist@colostate.edu. By January 15th, 2022. All members of the WAC community are encouraged to apply. For more information, please contact Mike. You can learn more about the Clearinghouse at wac.colostate.edu/about. Noor Ghazal Aswad is a doctoral candidate at the University of Memphis. Her research explores the forms of persuasion that mediate and situate broader ideological discourses surrounding refugees and immigrants and vulnerable others. Her dissertation, titled Syria as a Litmus Test Towards a Telos of Solidarity, puts forth the Syrian Revolution as a liberatory moment where revolutionaries rose from under an authoritarian regime's historic eclipse. Noor is motivated by the conviction that we must centralize the voices of Syrians themselves as a source of epistemological agency and not just as, quote, refugee figures, confined to undesirable humanitarian subjects or apolitical, quote, third persons in search of a homeland. Her work has been published in Rhetoric and Public Affairs and Critical Studies in Media Communication, among others. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Noor Ghazal Azwad. Who are you? What is your title, your institution, and your role there? What do you do?
Hi there. My name is Noor Ghazal Azwad. I'm a doctoral candidate in my last year at the University of Memphis right now. I'm in the Department of Communication and Media Studies. Sorry, and Film Studies, Department of Communication and Film Studies.
Department of Communication and Film Studies.
That's our latest name.
All right. Are you doing anything with film, or are you all more on the communication
side? No, sadly, they're kind of separate, but yeah, I am in the rhetoric and media side of things.
So you're at the University of Memphis studying rhetoric and media. Let's figure out how you got there. Are you from Memphis?
No, I am not. I mean, Memphis, so it's a bit of a long story. I'm married to a doctor. And so I'm not sure if you know how that works, but usually you do interviews for your residency and then you get an email telling you where you're going next. And so Memphis was our fifth option for residency. And so when we knew that he would be coming to Memphis for his fellowship, that's when I applied to the University of Memphis. So that was actually the only program I applied to, because that was where I knew that we had to be. And so I had to make the best of where I was.
So if you didn't grow up in Memphis, that's an interesting story, too, of how you got there. We're going to get more into that. Where did you grow up?
So I was born in the UK, and I was raised in Newcastle, a city called Newcastle upon Tyne. And so I've been around. I mean, I lived in England for, you know, when I was in my childhood, and then my family moved to Dubai for my teenage years, and I did my undergrad there, and I also worked there for a little bit before I eventually moved to the US in 2012. Now, so it's been almost 10 years now.
Incredible. So, what was it like growing up in the UK?
I mean, I really think fondly of those times. I mean, I have such happy memories of my childhood in England. We had a really nice community there. We still go back. So my brothers and my sister are all studying there now. They're working in London. And so I've been going back. And so I'm still very connected to England. So I have a soft spot for everything British still.
Sure. So you mentioned that around your teen years, your family moved to Abu Dhabi. What took you from the UK there?
So my father, I mean, I think it was a few things. He had already kind of got to a point in his career where he was doing, where he wanted to move back to the Arab world, at so-called Arab world. And so he moved back there, and part of it was for his work, and also because he wanted us to be raised in an Arab kind of culture and learn the language. And so there was a lot of that kind of purpose behind it as well. And so in a way, I'm happy that we went back, because I was able to connect with my roots. My family is originally from Syria. And so we were able to go there a lot more frequently because of that move. So we'd go there for winters and for summers and in between, and spend time with family there. And so that's kind of the reason why we moved. And my family still live there today.
So it sounds like your father valued the culture, right? So why do you think it was important for him to have you all raised in an Arab culture?
That's a complex question. I'm not sure if it's if I'm even really equipped to answer it, because as a person who is now living, you know, quote unquote, in the West and raising my children here myself, it is difficult, because you do have a pressure to assimilate. You have a pressure to... And not only a pressure, but also there's a sense of belonging that I feel even being here in the US now for so long, and my children were born here and they're raised here. And so I do think of myself as a world citizen. I've lived in several places and several cities. And so, the feeling of longing and belonging to certain places is out of our hands at times. And so It's funny how I often think of myself as very Syrian, even though, in fact, I wasn't born there or I wasn't raised there, but I still have a lot of attachment to Syria. And so I think every place I've been in has really contributed to who I am today, intellectually and also emotionally. And so I'm not sure if that answers your question. I'm kind of going on a different kind of thing. But yeah, I'm glad for everywhere I've been. It's all really helped me see the world in a different way. And I think if I'd been raised in the US, for instance, and doing what I'm doing now, I would have had a very different understanding of what I'm reading and how I see things, how I read things, how I look at things. It's very influenced by my background, naturally.
I think you're absolutely answering the question, and it was kind of a beautiful answer as well. Did you do your undergraduate studies in Abu Dhabi?
Yes, I was actually, yes, I was in United Arab Emirates University, which is the main kind of public university there. And so I did architectural engineering. And I also then did a master's degree right after in engineering systems management. And so my career is kind of strange. I've taken several strange turns, unexpected turns, but it was all for a purpose in the end. And I'm really happy that I am where I am now.
Certainly. Let's unpack it a little bit. So your bachelor's degree is in architectural engineering, which admittedly, I know nothing about. What even is architectural engineering? But more importantly, what was your passion connected to architectural engineering? What drew you to that field?
So, I mean, looking back now, I think a lot of when you're in high school, there's a lot of ignorance of what different jobs will entail, and we kind of go in blindly. And so at the time, I know I was very into the arts. I loved interior design. I loved architecture. And so I thought, okay, this might work. And I was, you know, I enjoyed studying architecture. I was a good student, and I did well. And I did an internship there. And then what happened was actually that when I was accepted for to go to Masdar Institute. So at the time, Masdar Institute was a brand new kind of university affiliated with MIT. And so they were looking for, it was a full scholarship. They were looking for students from around the world. And literally it was an amazing place to be, because when we came, I was the first batch of students. We had students from New Zealand, from America. We had from India, from Pakistan, from literally all around the world. And they had been recruited and all coming to this institute that was being built to look at sustainability, look at the environment, it was a very interdisciplinary kind of place to be. And all of the faculty had either worked at MIT or studied there, and they brought them in. And so they were building this kind of research institute. And so it was a two-year program, and they were actually still building Masdar itself. And so Masdar actually kind of relies completely on renewable energy. And so it was a very kind of intensive program to be in. And I ended up actually working with a faculty member who was doing policy research, so energy policy research. And so with her, she was a little bit more social science oriented than the rest, who were very, you know, science and engineering background and chemical engineering and things like that. So she was doing energy policy research. And it was, for me, that was a turning point, because so with her, my research project that I did for my graduation was looking at women in STEM. And so the participation of women in science, technology, and engineering fields, which, as you know, I mean, women always go into these fields in much lesser numbers than men. And they call it the leaky pipeline. So women, you know, they go into colleges, they go into study these fields, and then they start to drop out. Either when they graduate, they drop out of the field and they don't continue to work or, you know, find employment there. And so I wanted to kind of do a localized study. And so many of these studies at the time, this is 10 years ago now, more than 10 years ago, were looking at, you know, the Euro-American context, or studies in the MENA region had been at a very kind of surface level, or statistical analysis at a really kind of broad level. And so we wanted to do a really specific study to look at Emirati women. And so we did it was basically a quantitative and qualitative study where we interviewed Emirati women who were in those fields. And also we did surveys of university students in those fields. And then we interviewed faculty, female engineers, to get an understanding of their motivations for going into the field, obstacles they were facing, and also looking at some of the local policies that we're trying to instigate. This is kind of what they would call the knowledge-based economy, getting these women into these fields in greater numbers. What was attracting them? And so that kind of, for me, open the door to move more towards a social science kind of policy-based research interest. And so I really, really enjoyed working with her. Her name is Georgetta Vidican, and I'm still in touch with her. She was really instrumental for me, even seeing a female academic who was so successful and so supportive. And so that's how it kind of got started. And from there, I actually got a job at a large kind of government. It's not really an NGO. It's kind of, it's called IRENA. So it's a Renewable Energy Institute made up of member states. So it's a government organization, but it's kind of at the intra level. And so we had different member states, kind of function similar to the UN, where we would have a mandate every 2 years. And so I worked at the Renewable Energy Policy Directorate. And so I was researching renewable energy policies and rural electrification programs in rural areas. And so that's kind of how I got onto my track, a little bit of shifting away from architecture towards more policy or qualitative research, let's say.
Yeah, this sounds fascinating. So please indulge me for a moment. What are some of the day-to-day activities that you were doing at that job when you were looking at policy research, right? Researching policy for renewable energy. What were some of the day-to-day activities that you were doing?
So part of it was an amalgam of different things. Part of it was writing speeches for the director, like literally writing speeches for him to give to member states. Part of it was doing, we did reports. So we did, for instance, a report on renewable energy employment. So we were trying to argue that renewable energy was creating kind of a positive net employment for different countries. And so we did a report like that, a study on that. And then we went to Bangalore, where we spoke to these small business owners who were kind of looking at how, for cities that were off the grid, how, these small lamps or kind of renewable energy sources were providing them the ability to open businesses and to study and to work. And so we did several kind of things. I was there for around almost 2 years, I think. And it was really interesting. I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Is it something you've kept up with as you've moved on?
So I did work in environmental comms. Even when I came to Memphis, I was like, yeah, I'm doing environmental comm. This is what I do. And then somehow, again, I shifted gears when I came here.
I understand. Before you got to Memphis, you got a master's degree from North Dakota State University, master's of speech communication. I am not a global citizen, but I can surmise that living in Abu Dhabi is quite different from living in Fargo, North Dakota. Tell us a little bit about how you wound up there and what that program was like and what you wrote your master's degree about.
So that's a kind of two-pronged answer to that question. Part of it as well was that my husband matched in North Dakota. And so
I see.
Location was chosen for me again. But honestly, I wasn't even thinking of doing a second master's. I was done with graduate school. I was tired of academia. Uh-huh. I needed a break. That was how I felt about it. But funnily enough, we were immigrants, and I had come to the US so my husband had sponsored me on my visa. And so I came as with him. And so he actually had some visa issues, and he realized that he could no longer sponsor me as he moved on. So he was able to rely on what they call the TPS. It's called temporary protected status. So as a Syrian, he was able to rely on that. But I hadn't been living in the US long enough to qualify for TPS at that time. So I needed to get my own visa. And so literally, this is how it happened, is that he was like, you have to apply to study to get your own student visa, apply for anything, anywhere. We just need to get you to have a visa. So that was literally, we were like applying left and right and center. It wasn't well thought out. It wasn't, there was no Yeah, that's honestly how it happened. And so I applied to North Dakota State University, and I did apply for the Natural Resource Management Program. So that's what that my first semester I was with them, kind of wanting to follow on what I was doing before. But funnily enough, I took an elective in risk communication. And so I loved that class. It was Dr. Robert Littlefield, who eventually became my my advisor. And so he actually told me, hey, Noor, you know, he loved what I was doing. And he said, if you transfer to our program, we'll give you full funding. And I was like, sure, I'll transfer. And so that's how it happened.
Follow the money.
Follow the money. Exactly. I wish I had a better story, but that's how it happened.
I think it's a beautiful story. So what did you actually wind up writing about when you for your master's degree there?
So for my second master's, I didn't do a research project. He actually told me that you already have research, just do the exams. And so at that time, I did the exams, but I honestly really found myself in the field. I loved the courses I was taking. I really was excited and interested. And I think I felt like I should have been here all along. And so I'm really happy that this kind of this serendipitous line of events happened, because in the end, I really was happy to be there. And so once I finished, I decided to apply for my PhD, and the rest is history, as they say.
The University of Memphis. You're working on your dissertation. Syria as a litmus test towards a telos of solidarity. Okay, Noor, you'll have to bear with me. I don't know a whole lot about what we're going to talk about the rest of this episode.
I'll
and
walk I you through think, it.
And I think that this is an opportunity, perhaps, for me to say that not enough Americans know what's going on with your dissertation project, right? Tell us a little about your experience at the University of Memphis and how those experiences built to this dissertation.
Memphis has been really interesting. As I said, I wasn't actually into rhetoric until I came here, and I took a class with my advisor now, Antonio De Velasco, and we took a class in political communication, and he is a rhetorician. And so after taking that class, I really started to really see that rhetoric was a great way to look at the issues and approach the issues that I was, or the exigencies that I was seeing in the world. And at the time, you know, the Syrian revolution started in 2011. And at the time, as a person who was living outside of Syria, the main kind of news item about Syria was the refugee crisis, right? So you had this huge refugee exodus. Currently, I think over half of the Syrian population is displaced. So you have half that are internally displaced and half that are displaced outside of Syria's borders. And so you really began to see in the media, these especially kind of political figures and media discourses trying to mediate and understand what was happening and kind of placing the refugee figure and how to approach them. And so that is kind of what happened, is that I really began to look at seeing how these refugee figures were being looked at as these humanitarian subjects. They were seen as apolitical third persons who were looking for a homeland. There was this kind of spectacle of suffering, a lot of focus in the media on the geopolitical aspects of it. Also, the term civil war was being thrown around a lot, and it camouflaged a lot of what was happening at the roots of the crisis, which was that we had one of the most inspiring revolutions of the 21st century. And so I wanted to see how we could acknowledge these refugees as, and the term that I love here is, they were refugees trained in revolution. Many of them were not apolitical people. They were people who had agency and who had got to protest, and they had a story to tell. And so I felt like that was being camouflaged in the media. And so the first kind of thing that got me into looking at immigration and rhetoric and rhetoric surrounding migrants and refugees was looking at the case of Nikki Haley. And I was really kind of interested to see how she, how her discourse navigated various competing moralities, let's say, or competing principles. And so that's kind of one of the first studies that I did, where I wanted to to dig into her rhetoric and see how she positioned herself and how she was also very different from the kind of exclusionary nationalism, this kind of jingoistic, blatantly racist rhetoric of President Trump. And she was kind of offering an alternative that was, to me, I felt very insidious and also surreptitious in the way that she was kind of using various narrative elements or rhetorical moves to reject refugees from her state. Yeah, so I mean, Nikki Haley is interesting to look at because she really kind of offers this, what I call this transcendent perspective, which I call redemptive exclusion, okay. Where she would kind of co-articulate this discourse where she had xenophobic discourses of exclusion, but at the same time, she was still staying loyal to this mythic promise of an America which is open to all. And so she would offer these antithetical gestures of inclusion and then exclusion at the same time. And interestingly, Nikki Haley is kind of a fascinating case to look at because she would rely on her own personal ethos as the child of immigrants. Mm. And so she would really lean into this discourse of her own ethotic grounding as a child of immigrants, as a person who has benefited from American moral exceptionalism. And so she would use that almost like as an ethotic prolepsis, kind of anticipating possible objections to what she was going to say with the Syrian refugees. And so offer this out almost in every single speech that she would give, she would mention this. Then she would move on to these hyperbolic narratives of American moral exceptionalism as America built on immigrants and a nation of immigrants is the term that she would always use. And then from there, she would then springboard to this idea of Syrian refugees as potential terrorists, as people that we cannot vet, as unknown, as illegals, as potential terrorists. And so she would kind of extrapolate them out. I'm not sure if that's the right word, kind of take them out of all of these kind of like constraining and qualifying this mythic ideal of America. Uh-huh. And then say that these refugees are an exception to all of this. And so that was a project that kind of got me started at looking at this, at the Syrian refugee crisis. But then from there, I wanted to look further at the roots of the refugee exodus, which is the Syrian revolution.
More after this.
Would you like to join Charles in the Big Rhetorical Podcast? The podcast is booking for next season now. The Big Rhetorical Podcast offers participants the opportunity to contribute to ongoing conversations within our disciplines and beyond. This record of conversations eventually will be a digital archive with the potential to impact the knowledge making in rhetoric, writing studies, and technical communication, as well as adjacent fields. Do you have a new book coming out? Are you hitting the job market this cycle? The Big Rhetorical Podcast wants to talk to you. The Big Rhetorical Podcast core ideals are similar to a community-based writing project, with an emphasis on inclusivity and localizing knowledge and in strengthening relationships among peers. Make sure to check out our back catalog of episodes, as well as listen to our new podcast each week wherever you listen to your podcast. If you have questions about the Big Rhetorical Podcast, please submit a form at the website www.thebigrhetoricalpodcast.weebly.com. You can also find the Big Rhetorical Podcast on Twitter at TheBigRhet. Follow the podcast on Facebook or email us at thebigrhetorical@gmail.com.
Welcome back. There's so much here and so much fascinating content to talk about. First of all, I think this is a fascinating, frankly, brilliant connection to make between these non-apolitical actors and their agency, and then the way that their agency is kind of stripped or removed by certain rhetoric from the West, from Nikki Haley, right? Which is, you're right, she is a fascinating, truly fascinating figure, perhaps understudied in many ways. But what we know about her is that she is one cog, one piece of a much larger machine that's doing a lot of harm in our world. Could you talk a little bit about how that is just one part of the problem with the way that certain political actors use these insidious rhetorical moves?
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent question, Charles. And now, to kind of follow up on what I was saying earlier and also kind of in a way to answer your question as well, is that the way that the refugee has been approached as being an apolitical victim also kind of carries over into how we've seen the Syrian revolution and how we've seen Syrian revolutionaries. And so to give a little bit of background for those who might not know about the revolution, so basically in 2011, the so-called Arab Spring started. And so I don't like to call it the Arab Spring because it really wasn't only Arabs that were out there. People from all over, from different intersectionalities, different races, different religions, different faiths, ethnicities were all coming out together in this common recognition of the oppressor, right? And so for many years, there had been political silence in Syria about the Assad regime. So the Assad regime has been in power now for 50 years. And so it wasn't like a new thing, but there had been this kind of, to an outsider, it seemed like there was no political resistance. There was silence. And they even called Syria the Kingdom of Silence. Syrians were afraid to talk even within their own four walls. And so, you know, the Arab Spring, so-called Arab Spring, started in Tunis and Egypt. It took a while, but it eventually popped up in Syria. And it really erupted. I mean, the words that you hear used here are tornado, eruption. It came out like a fever. Like it just, it was magnetic. It was so inspiring to see people who were so scared of even voicing their opinions in public now coming out in protest, right? And so it started in a really small town of Daraa, and the story is well known now, but some schoolboys put some graffiti on a wall where they said, "Jaik Doria Diktor," so your turn is next doctor, in reference to Bashar al-Assad, who is, you know, Dr. Bashar al-Assad. And so those boys were taken, they were tortured, and then a small protest started in Daraa. The protesters were also taken, and one of the most, you know, the instigators for the revolution really was a small boy called Hamza al-Khatib. I think he was 13 or 14 years old. He was taken by police forces. He was tortured. He was mutilated. There were gunshot wounds. He was tortured with there were like cigarette burns on his skin. And so his body was returned to his parents a month later. And his parents actually videotaped his body and they put the video online. And this, I mean, talking about it now, even now, when I think about it, like the hands, the hair on my body stands up, because that was, I mean, when people saw what the regime had done to him, and it was kind of teaching people a lesson, like, if you're going to protest, this is what's going to happen to you. Instead of being coward or scared, Syrians actually couldn't take it anymore. And so that situation is what took the revolution from this abyss of potentiality to the actuality of revolution. And so you begin to see across Syria these huge protests starting, even in the larger cities. And so it started with Daraa, moved to, you know, smaller cities, and then eventually you see in Aleppo and Homs and Damascus, these larger protests start to happen. And they were asking for dignity. They were asking for what we call karama. And initially, it was actually not even asking for the removal of the regime. They were asking for reform. And so they were asking for the repeal of the emergency law, which was a law which allowed the regime to arrest anybody with no legal, you know, anybody that they wanted to take, they could question, they could detain under this emergency law. They were asking for the legalization of parties outside of the Ba'ath Party, because it was a one-party state. They wanted the release of prisoners of conscience. They were asking for the lifting of restrictions of personal freedoms. But immediately you see that the regime began shooting at protesters. There were shoot to kill orders. There were snipers on the rooftops. And it eventually escalated to where whole cities were sieged, to where there was a collective punishment on anybody who was going to not only to protest, even those, even the worker, the people who are coming in to rescue the protesters, you know, the Red Cross or the Red Crescent who are coming in, even they were then attacked and killed, even for daring to come in to help. And so it really kind of escalated. And from then, you see this peaceful revolution. And it was peaceful for over a year. And they were holding flowers. They were telling the army, you know, the army and the people, we are one people, don't shoot us. But and so you actually begin to see people from the military begin to defect. And you begin to see these protesters who are peaceful begin to want to defend themselves. because of this, you know, intense repression, they began to feel that if I'm dying anyway, let me die defending myself, defending my city, defending my people. And so they begin to pick up arms. And that's where you actually see the narrative begin to change, because before they were peaceful protesters and now they are people who are in armed resistance. And so they no longer fit into this apolitical, they're no longer these easy victims to empathize with. Now they are complex political victims who are now in resistance. And not only that, they speak in the Arab vernacular. They don't fit into normative scripts of resistance. And also, the Assad regime immediately began to call protesters terrorists, extremists, Salafi terrorists. And so this narrative was immediately pushed by the regime on these peaceful protesters. Even at that stage, they were being kind of tarnished in that way. And so quickly it became a lot more complex. And so you see how these complex political victims are kind of no longer fit into this narrative. And then you begin to see that, you know, the ISIS and Daesh and Al-Qaeda begin to come onto the scene. And so they're kind of hijacking the Syrian revolution for their own purposes. And this kind of allowed for this conflation where anybody who was a resistance fighter or part of the Free Syrian Army now under these kind of hegemonic narratives on Syria, they are all wholesale terrorists. There was no differentiation between those who were, quote unquote, moderate fighters or those who were, did not lean into this kind of, you know, and they were all kind of put under this one monstrous identity of extremism. And in a way that whitewashed the regime's crimes, because people would say, OK, this is the alternative. Like, no, he is better. And so for Syrians, we don't believe he is better. You know, he is responsible for more than 94% of the deaths in Syria. And the thing is, for Syria is an interesting case to look at because it is the most documented revolution in history in the 21st century. The amount of firsthand documentation of the atrocities that happened, thousands and thousands of videos, images uploaded online by journalists, by people who were testifying, people who were witnessing what was happening, witnessing their own destruction. Going out, you know, with immense bravery. And so despite this overwhelming amount of evidence of what was happening, you still see this kind of shadow of doubt about what was happening. Oh, it's too confusing. Oh, it's too complex. It's misunderstood, as a way to kind of wash your hands of it. And so the narratives began to, you begin to see these well-known journalists, such as Robert Fisk, for instance, who are saying, you know, all these Syrian revolutionaries are, quote unquote, exempt of good guys. Or they're proxies of Western imperialism, or they're all Islamic extremists. And so these kind of narratives begin to really erase the heroic stories of these revolutionaries, many of them who were, you know, they had beautiful stories to tell and sacrifice. And so this is where my interest of looking at the radical subject, which I call, you know, these Syrian revolutionaries who are going out with embodied agency, with the known risk of death, of imprisonment to themselves and their families. And what are they saying? What is their rhetoric? What is their lived experience? And how can we use this approach to look at the revolution?
So much of this work, so much of your work looks at bodies, right? The bodies, whether it's the refugee body or the body of the young man who is mutilated and tortured. What can we learn from studying bodies and the movement of bodies across borders?
I love that question, Charles. That's exactly kind of how I see the radical subject. And I think what I'm moving towards arguing with my dissertation. So it's still in progress and I'm still kind of exploring these ideas. But a lot of it is also looking at this, the Foucauldian discursive turn, right? So where you have all these discourses and you want to include a kaleidoscope of opinions and by intellectuals and by journalists and by this and by that. And what gets lost in this is the testimony of those who have used their bodies and have risked their lives, their literal lives, for their struggle for freedom, okay? And so I really kind of wanted to define, put a finger on it, like, who are these people and can we identify them and can we value their words and their testimony and not just allow them to be kind of figureheads? And so the radical subject really has this corporeal quality where they use their body with purposeful political action. And they kind of, they're subjects who emerge out of these revolutionary moments in history. They often from historically oppressed communities, and I'll come later to the idea of how they are historically oppressed. They're not just coming out of this moment, but they have testimony, which is generational testimony. They were in crisis and they were revolting against these repressive hegemonic forces. And the idea is that when you have this kind of discursive, these discursive formations that come from everywhere, is that there's the idea that nothing is really the truth, that all of these discourses matter, and there's nothing is really morally superior. And so my argument is really to say that these bodies that have resisted, they do hold some kind of non-perspectival aletheia or some kind of truth of what happened to them. And the case of Syria is interesting because the state would not allow for third parties to come in and observe. There was almost no journalism. It was very hard for journalists to come in. The few that were able to come in had to come in secretly across borders. They weren't allowed, they weren't given license by the state. And so in many of these cases, Syrians were the only people to testify to what was happening to them because there was no third objective, quote, objective party to come and verify their stories, right? And so really when you have this kind of, this cataclysm of what's happening, and on top of that, you don't have even a third party coming in to really observe and verify, it's very easy to cast doubt on their stories. And so when I look at the radical subject, I really see them as having this kind of ontological positioning anchored in their historical, political, and social location. And their location here is really kind of epistemically salient. You see what I'm saying? And so I'm also kind of looking, and this is not in the radical rhetoric paper, but I'm also looking at the role of post-memory. And so for those, you know, post-memory is a term by Marianne Hirsch, where she looks at the generation after the Holocaust, how that generation who didn't live the Holocaust, how they kind of inherit this collective trauma, this personal trauma from their families, even though they didn't live the Holocaust itself.
Sure.
And so there's an intergenerational kind of witnessing which occurs and transfer inheritance of memory from your family and your forefathers. And so in the case of Syria, I mean, before the revolution even happened in the 80s, there also was, you know, a significant kind of resistance, political resistance against the regime. Several massacres occurred, after which there was severe repression. There was no, like I said, Syria became a kingdom of silence.
Right.
These stories of those massacres and what happened, they were not, there was no public iconography to remember it. It was not in museums. It was not in the history books, but it survived inside the private domain of families. And so you see how there's a knowledge, which I'm kind of arguing that there's this post-memory, but I put post in quotes, or sorry, in brackets, because it's a post-memory, but also the regime is still an oppressive actor. So there's a living memory of the regime, and also there's a post-memory of what the regime is able to do. And so the Syrians, we are very familiar with the repertoire of tactics of the regime, how it detains people, how it monitors them, how it surveils them. And also they're also familiar with repertoires of resistance, even within their own homes, how they can use their intergenerational whisperings or storytelling to transfer knowledge to the next generation. And so when these radical subjects come, they're not coming out of nowhere. They are already familiar with the regime. So their testimony has that grounding of the knowledge that they have inherited from their ancestors and from things that they have seen or lived or things that they haven't seen themselves, but that they have that they still have that kind of the history of a previous era that they didn't live themselves. And so when you come to look at their discourse, can you weigh it the same as a discourse of a person who is coming as an outsider or never been to Syria or coming in on a trip for, the, you know, a regime-sponsored trip to come and see what's happening, and then discrediting revolutionaries and saying that we know what's happening in Syria? And so how can we make meaning, determinative meaning, how can we actually create solidarity? Because what's happening when this narrative gets lost, solidarity doesn't happen. It becomes too complex. It becomes a conflict that we can wash our hands of because we don't know what's happening and there's too many discourses, there's too much information, and there's doubt. And so how can we move towards, actionable solidarity?
How do you see your role in the Syrian revolution?
I mean, to me, my role is, I really don't want to put myself, I mean, okay, let me just think about that for a second.
Sure.
What I want to do, it, to me, when I'm talking about the radical subjects, they're not just some anonymous, unknown figures. These are real people. And so what I've wanted to do is to really actually identify their names and their stories and derive and really kind of use this struggle for freedom as a way for us to kind of pause, learn, listen from their stories, from their testimony, and even derive, you know, I think, I mean, for me, the Syrian Revolution offers us a way to rethink colonialism, to rethink authoritarianism, to look at social movements differently. How do you define the success of a revolution, the failure of a revolution? What is it? What do revolutions want to attain? What is the starting point of a revolution? What is the end point of a revolution? All these questions to me. It's really, I think the revolution is a really challenging case because it's a microcosm of all of these difficult circumstances, which make it very easy to erase if you're using this Euro-American reason to look at the revolution from this revolution from the global south, which is really kind of pushes all the buttons that makes it very easy to turn away. And so for me, I want to kind of learn from the revolution and I want to honor the stories and hopefully from there also offer some kind of paradigm for how we can approach social movements that fall into this kind of these parameters and learn from it and maybe even take it different places and spaces.
What connections, if any, are you seeing between the work, the importance and the work that you're doing and the refugee crisis at the U.S. southern border?
I mean, honestly, I need to think a little bit more about that. I feel like I want to give you a more in-depth answer than what I'm prepared for with that question.
Okay.
But I definitely see lots of resonance between the Syrian Revolution and between what's happening at the Mexican border, what is happening in, you know, I love looking at the rhetoric of Subcomandante Marcos and seeing how he also, their fight for liberation has really been inspirational to me. There's a lot of even the Black Lives Matter movement and how those who resist in that movement are portrayed and how they are negated and how their resistance is no longer makes them worthy the moment they resist and they don't fall into these normative, their resistance doesn't please us. You know, people begin to negate their resistance and see and find a way to not offer them solidarity. And so I definitely see a lot of resonance between the Syrian Revolution and between others. At the same time, it's definitely different. You know, it's definitely in a different context and it offers different challenges.
Right.
And so, you know, the authoritarian kind of regime is very different because at least in America, you have you have civil society. You have some room for freedom of expression, no matter how, you know, even if it's small, restrained, it's not perfect, but you still have that. Whereas Syria really is an extreme case where Syrians were also challenged in that for many years, they couldn't build civil society. They couldn't organize. And so when the revolution happened, they were, in many respects, they were not ready. They weren't prepared because they had to learn while they were in revolution. They were also learning how to resist and how to form organizations. And that's these stories, these amazing stories don't even show up in the media, but you have when the regime, so the Free Syrian Army began to liberate various areas of Syria. And so there was a vacuum where there was no government. And you begin to see these LCCs, these local coordination committees, which come in, activists would come together and they would be documenting the what was happening by the regime. They would be opening up schools, they would be hospitals. And so they really began to really kind of almost like in this anarchist way, rule themselves and offer an alternative of what life under authoritarian could be. So some kind of an alternative that is real. Some people say that there's no other alternative. No, there are. And that's, I mean, we have so many beautiful stories of what life could be like. And so, yeah, so the Syrian situation, I think, is so instrumental and really interesting to look at because it's unique in many ways, but also shares a lot of similarities with Palestine, with Black Lives Matter, with what's happening at the border. And there's just a treasure trove of rhetoric there that can be looked at and learned from.
Thank you, Noor, for taking on that big question. I appreciate it. That was an eloquent answer as well.
Okay.
To me, Noor, you are a storyteller and a historian. You're an archivist and you're a scholar through this work, but you also write for the public, meaning you've published some newspaper articles about the Syrian Revolution. My question is not necessarily based about the content, but more so, why is it important for you to write for a public audience about this topic?
I mean, honestly, first of all, it's a lot shorter to write an article for a journal than to, for the public than to write an academic journal and put it through peer review. And so that really kind of started with this idea of wanting to express things quickly that I couldn't express or would take time to express and really kind of flesh out in an academic article. But I've also really found that these kind of articles that are freely available, which we underestimate that many academic journals are not freely available to everybody. They're not always downloadable by those who don't have access to these databases. And so they're a lot more instantly shareable and they resonate quickly. And so I've actually really felt that sometimes I can express an idea or an argument in some kind of form. Obviously, it doesn't take the place of these academic articles, but I felt that that's a way for me to stay connected to the grassroots, to the people who actually I'm trying this is my community, right? And so when I'm publishing in that way, I've really felt it's just been so immensely rewarding and I've really kind of enjoyed it. I don't have enough time to always do that. But yeah, I did have two articles that came out, I think, last year. One of them was on the 10th anniversary of the revolution. And that was just such a sad moment for many of us. I mean, so many Syrians were heartbroken that it was 10 years now. And many were saying this revolution has been a failure. And when I'd hear the word failure thrown about, like I'd feel my heart break because then it almost seems like all these lives lost have been for nothing. Like we've gained nothing by this. And so I really began to kind of think a little bit more about how do we define revolutionary success and failure? And that was kind of where that article kind of came about is if we're going to look at the geopolitical dimensions and if we're going to look at, you know, Assad is still in power today, then yes, it was a failure. But if you look deeper into the surface of what has happened to Syrians and Syrians in the diaspora who are now speaking, just like I'm speaking to you now, sharing their stories, sharing their testimony, trying to create change from within Syria and from outside of Syria, and how much Syrians have been changed, how much their consciousness has changed in the last years. There's another story to tell about what revolution really is, which is a lot less superficial than just this top-down kind of examination of revolution. And so that was very cathartic for me to write, just for me to kind of to give ode to the revolution and what it has achieved and what it's still achieving. And it's still in its early days in some ways. And also, you know, on World Refugee Day, I also kind of wrote an article looking at this apolitical refugee figure who are really kind of revolutionaries. And I think there's still a lot more to be said about that. You know, Wendy Perlman actually has a really interesting book, which kind of looks at, she interviewed refugees. It's called We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled. It's a beautiful title. It's actually taken from a quote by one of the refugees. And you read the stories of refugees and their stories of protest and their stories of going out in the streets. And there's you know, and so it really gives you this, we are able to see the full complexity of the refugee and not just a person kind of running away for their own safety. That's so much more interesting and so much more nuanced than that.
Noor, what are you going to do this afternoon?
This afternoon? Oh, I have a long list of things to do. I'm writing the dissertation right now. So I just submitted a chapter to my professor. I have to revise another. I mean, literally, I'm at it right now. I'm just in the writing mode. I'm reading and writing all the time. And so that's my exciting afternoon for today.
Thanks for taking time to sit with me for an interview.
Thank you so much, Charles. I really appreciate the opportunity and how wonderful you've been. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Noor Ghazal Aswad. Her work is critical for our discipline and for the expansion of our field and for Syria. I can't wait to see what she does next. Thank you, Noor, for sharing your brilliance with all of us. I'll be back next week with our two-part season 5 finale, which features 2 new episodes in our Keystone Perspectives series. Until then, always be listening rhetorically. The Big Rhetorical Podcast is produced by Exalt Digital Media, Exalt Digital Media, not for profit. This podcast was recorded on the sacred lands of the Tuscarora people, and we recognize and respect the people of the Kahori, Eastern Band of Cherokee, Haliwa Saponi, Meherrin, Okanichi, Band of Saponi, Saponi, and Waccamaw Siouan.
Music for the Big Rhetorical Podcast is brought to you by DJ Lane, Grapes, and Airtones.